It has just been really good to be here today, to sit and listen to my best friends and role models, and I feel like I don't have anything great to add after the good stuff that they shared with us. But I do love to talk about practical things, and my topic today is more practical. So we're going to switch gears a little bit and turn our brains to the practical setting for this next session. The title is Your House, a Haven. Homes are a big part of our lives. We often hear inspirational thoughts about making our homes a haven for our families and friends. We discuss things that we can do to create the atmosphere of security and comfort, a home that nurtures and brings belonging and connection. Spending a lot of our time and energy creating that haven is a really good thing, and we as homemakers have a really special opportunity to set the tone in the places that we live and turn our houses into homes. And that's, yeah, like I said, really important work, and one that we should put a lot of time and energy into doing well. So we could spend the next hour discussing just that, the high calling of being a homemaker, and there would be a lot of good things for us to talk about. But I would like to focus in on the housekeeping part of our homemaking. While the way that we keep our houses probably isn't as important as some areas in our lives, it is a big part of our lives. And so I would like to just look at some practical ways that we can do it well, and also how we can overcome the overwhelm that often comes with being in charge of a house. In the Lord's Prayer, Jesus taught us to pray, "Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." A friend of mine recently shared the thought with me that we can pray that prayer for our homes, a prayer that says, "Your will be done in my home as it is in heaven." And I really liked that thought. And so today, I want to take it a step further and think about what it looks like if we pray, "Your will be done in my house as it is in heaven." So does the housekeeping part of homemaking matter? The decluttering, organizing, and managing our things, how we handle our daily chores, and the way we decorate and maintain our house. These are the things I want to talk about, but are they important to God? And does the Bible have anything to say about them? We will revisit those questions later towards the end. But in our American culture today, I think homemaking is mostly seen as unimportant. Cleaning, organizing, cooking, managing schedules, etc., is looked upon as maybe less desirable than what some people might call going out and making a difference. How did we get to this point of view, the American culture, seeing the work of home as boring or less than? I found a little history lesson in a book called Every Home a Foundation, written by Felicia Masonheimer. And I'd like to just read a little bit of that history just because I thought it was interesting. She says, "Coming up out of the medieval era, mothers, daughters, fathers, and sons alike worked together in their living spaces just to survive. Gardening, tending animals, sewing, mending, knitting, things that we might think of as hobbies today were essential just to live. Living well at home was an act of stewardship. Do all things as unto the Lord was more than a concept. It was their lifestyle. Habits of homemaking were handed down generation to generation. Parents and grandparents handed down the knowledge and appreciation of home and its purpose. When the Industrial Revolution came along, machines made man-made things more inefficient and eventually obsolete. With new inventions and factories taking over a lot of the work, men began to leave home for work at factories, railroads, or banks. With men spending long days working away from home to provide, the tasks of home more naturally fell on the women now. So, because it was easier for people to make more money, and because of the value placed on financial success, the work of home, or the non-income producing work, came to be seen as less valuable. When World War I and II crashed onto the scene, more and more women started to leave the home to work in the factories as well. With the war effort, there was a new note of admiration for working women. They were seen as helping to win the war. American culture realized then that women were effective, efficient, and intelligent workers. When the war ended and women returned to their homes, discontentment began to pervade the women of America. They had experienced work in a place where their contribution was measurable, observable, and impactful. That's not always the way we feel about the mundane work at home. This, coupled with the invention of time-saving machines in the home, like microwaves, vacuums, refrigerators, and dishwashers, made home tasks both less time-consuming and less appealing. And by the 1960s, no one needed to tell American women that tending the home was boring. They felt it. Women could have it all. They could join the workforce and enjoy all the rights that men did. The work of home came to be seen as oppressive and limiting. Through a combination of many factors, home lost its purpose and the work of home lost its meaning. The generation who believed domestic tasks to be oppressive did not think it was necessary to hand down the skills to the next generation. But when those daughters decided they wanted more than the workaholism of the generation before, they were left overwhelmed and empty-handed, trying to learn home skills they were never taught while still working full-time jobs. So that brings us to today, where our houses are often things that we want to share online. We end up feeling like we can't open our doors to the people in our real lives because we are suffocated by the perfectionism we see in other people's houses. And our pack schedules often don't allow us very much time to focus on creating that warm and inviting home for our loved ones. Domestic tasks are seen as more unimportant, and yet, when we abandon these things, we feel overwhelmed, cluttered, and sad. So we are blessed, I think, in our more conservative circles that our culture has probably hung on to the value of homemaking and women in the home more than maybe most of the people around us. But I think if we're honest with ourselves, we need to admit that we're not always exempt from the negative feelings towards our homes and the tasks of keeping a house. So we might feel resentment and frustration when we think of our houses because there's often a long list of imperfections. The carpet is stained, the countertop is dated, the cabinet door just keeps opening on its own, and we can't always change these things about our houses. Renovations and remodeling take a lot of money, and it seems like there's often more important things that take priority. And that can be frustrating. But what if we decided to stop rolling our eyes at those quirky corners of the house and instead decided to embrace the art in housekeeping and focus on learning things that we can do to make our houses run smoothly and make the best of what we have to work with? This comes more naturally for some people than for others. But I believe keeping a house well is something we can all learn to do, and I think it's something that we never stop learning to do better. The first thing I have is management of our things. This is probably one of the biggest jobs we have in housekeeping. And I think that one of the biggest things that keeps us from managing our things well is having too many of them. It is so easy for us to end up with so much stuff. Consumerism is pushed on us everywhere that we turn. Social media can bring a culture of comparison, and we end up buying stuff to try to maintain that picture-worthy lifestyle. We turn on our favorite podcast while we clean our house or fold our laundry, but in between being entertained, we hear about two or three or four products that promise to make our lives better. Advertisements are not just simple advertisements. They are strategically designed to create a fear of missing out and an urgency to purchase. They send persuasive messages that this product will fill a void in our lives. It's really simple for us to pick up our phones and order something with 3 minutes and a click of a button. And 1 or 2 days later, a package gets dropped at our front door, and just like that, something else has entered our home for us to manage. Our brains also play a lot of sneaky little tricks on us. When we buy something, our brains actually release dopamine, a hormone that is sometimes called the happy hormone. It's a really nice distraction when we're stressed or overwhelmed. I thought this was really interesting because if you pay attention, you might notice that you get that urge to take a shopping trip in the times that you have a million other things you should be doing or thinking about. Researchers have also found that our brains actually get attached to our things. And especially if we have invested a lot of time or money into those things. But the crazy thing is that when we try to let go of those things that our brains have become connected to, our brain actually experiences the same thing it does as when we get physically hurt, like when we get a paper cut or stub our toe. So with all those things in mind, it's really not a wonder that our houses fill up with stuff without us even realizing that it's happening. A little story. After returning from living in Kenya, Africa, our family moved into a house that was going to be torn down. The plan was that we would move in and fix it up just a little bit until we found something more permanent. Well, this little bit of fixing up turned into more fixing up, and eventually this house became the more permanent place that we had planned to find, and tearing it down was no longer in the picture. Because it was a very old house with lots of great character, and guests that came to our house often wanted to tour around and see what we had done to the place that we now call the old mansion. One such guest, after looking through the house, he said, "This is nice, but where is your stuff? Do you even live here? Like, where are your things?" My mom, feeling a little bit confused, said, "I'm not sure, maybe at the thrift store?" My older brother, Jeremiah, who was a young boy at the time, piped up and said, "Yeah, it's at the thrift store. I'm always worried I might be the next thing to go." So that's a funny story, but it just goes to show that for some of us, like my mom, decluttering and getting rid of things comes more naturally and easier than for others. Some of us, like the man touring our house, might tend to feel more secure and cozy when they're surrounded by their belongings. But the truth is that whether we like a lot of things or whether we are more naturally bent towards fewer things, our possessions do affect us. One research team observed 32 different families and found that in all of these families, the mother's stress hormones actually spiked during the time that she spent thinking about their things. They found that even things that we don't necessarily see when we look around the house, like files on our computers or storage in our attics or notifications on our phones, papers in our desk drawers, they all contribute to the amount of things that can cause our brains to feel overloaded. And aside from the increased stress levels, too much stuff is thought to reduce our productivity and squelch our creativity. So, obviously, some things are going to add value to our lives. But from this research, it sounds like we want to be pretty careful if we really do want our things to add value and not take away. We don't need to be extreme minimalists, though, to manage our things well. Our children don't have to worry that we'll box them up and haul them to Goodwill. But I think that we can all agree that common sense tells us that the less we have, the easier it will be to manage. So I have a few questions for us to think about that might help us with that and help us to cut down on the amount of things that we own. The first one is to ask yourself, am I being intentional? We should be making deliberate choices about what is actually going to add value to our life. It's really easy to bring something home from the store just because it's cute, or I don't have one of these, or maybe it was a really good deal. But is it a good deal if it doesn't add value? If it's only another thing in your life to find a place for, clean around, and maintain. Second question is, can I simplify? Do I have a lot of gadgets that make things only slightly easier once or twice a year, but I really could get the same thing done, the same task accomplished without them? Consider if the real estate that those things are taking up in your cabinets and in your brain might be more useful to you than the tool itself. So do I need a tortilla warmer if I can wrap it in tinfoil instead? Or a rice cooker if I can make it just as well in a kettle or in the stove? The third question is, quantity or quality better? Do I need an entire cabinet full of water bottles? Or do I always reach for the same one anyway? We might think it's handier to be well stocked up on things like that. But is it really? If you didn't have the option to grab a clean one and let your dirty one in the sink, would it eliminate that constant pile of dirty water bottles in the sink? And if each family member had just one, would it be motivation to put them where they belong rather than littering the vehicles in the yards with them? Number four is, am I practicing gratitude? As humans, ever full of our Adamic natures, we default to focusing on things that we don't have or think we need. And it takes a lot more effort to think about what we already have and to be grateful. But I think that if we can train our brains to adopt that attitude of gratitude, it will have a big effect on the things that we wish for and want to buy. So choosing to be grateful and focusing on what we already have, like we heard in Abigail's topic, is known to have a positive effect on both our physical and mental well-being. It makes us happier people in general. But another great side benefit to that is that it will likely lead to us saying no to purchases that we might otherwise make. And in return, we might experience more financial stability too, and therefore a greater peace of mind. And the last question I have is, am I hanging on to things that I might use later? This one is a big one for me because I am a do-it-yourself girl. I love crafting, and I can get excited and inspired by things that a lot of people would probably call trash. And That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does tend to make me hang on to stuff just in case or for a project sometime. Some of you can probably relate to that. We already talked about how our things, even when they are tucked away in storage, are taking up brain space and brain energy. So when we go to the storage room and we see that big box of fabric scraps, we think, I really should cut those up and make a quilt top. And the big box of yarn reminds us that I was going to teach myself to knit this winter. And the box of mismatched glass jars, we don't know what we'll do with, but there's surely something. And by the time that we walk away from the storage room, our brain is handling a long list of mental to-dos. I can't remember who I heard this little lesson from, but it made a lot of sense to me, and it has helped me with that a little bit to sort through what I actually do want to hang on to and when I can let things go. They said this, imagine that you are a college student. You are loaded with assignments. You can barely keep up with all your homework. You are overwhelmed, and you see absolutely no way that you're going to get it all done. One day, you go to class, and the professor announces, you all have a lot on your plate. I'm going to give you a choice. You can either do all the assignments I've given you, or you can choose to skip them. If you choose to skip them, you simply won't be graded on those assignments. You look at him with confusion. Is he serious? We can just let him go, just skip him, and there won't be any bad consequences? Yes, he assures you, no bad grades. I just wanted to free you from some of your overwhelm. Imagine the relief if you would be that student. The stress that would be taken off your shoulders. And imagine how much better you would be able to focus on the rest of your tasks and assignments. So, what does this have to do with projects in the storage room? Well, when it comes to the things that you're hanging on to for sometime later or just in case, you are the teacher and you are the student. Every time that you choose to keep something, you are giving yourself another assignment, another task, and another mental to-do. But you also have the freedom to say, I don't need to do these things. I can let them go, and there will be no bad grade. You are free to be relieved. Maybe you can focus on the rest of your tasks much better again. So now that we've established that less is truly more, let's all go home and fill a dumpster, right? No, obviously, we still have things to manage. So I'd like to just look at some practical ways to help us manage what is going to stay in our house. The first tip I have is to give everything a home. Clutter happens really quickly when we don't have a designated spot for everything. It ends up wasting our time because we can't find things that we need when we need them, and because we shuffle homeless items around from this spot to the other spot because we don't really know where to go with them or what to do with them. So take some time to think through where it makes sense to keep things. If it's random mail that's always cluttering your countertops, maybe you'll designate a drawer or a basket right inside the door that you can easily drop those papers into. Try to make putting things in their home more easy, more convenient and accessible than, say, dropping them on the kitchen counter. Maybe you could put a pretty bowl on top of the fridge for all those random garage paraphernalia that somehow finds its way into the house. It's not exactly a home for those things, but it is a temporary spot where you can easily find them the next time someone comes looking, and it keeps your surfaces clutter-free. Another idea that I love is to keep a donate box in a central place where you can easily throw those items you come across that you no longer need. Every time you throw something into that bin, it means one less thing, one less decision you need to make later. And it also means one less thing floating around your house that you're not using. And that's always a win. The second tip is to find your organizing style. We've probably all experienced spending hours organizing a space in our house. We carefully arrange everything into neat piles and bins, and it looks absolutely amazing for about 2 days. And then it looks like a tornado went through and we never did anything at all. So like most things in housekeeping, organization is not really a once and done thing. It's something that we have to keep doing over and over again. But finding an organizing method that fits you and your family's needs, I think, can be really helpful to keep those closets and cabinets and shelves functional and neat for a longer amount of time because you've done it in a way that works well for you. Cass Arson is a professional organizer who calls herself a recovering super slob. After living years of her life among debilitating clutter and chaos in her home, Cass turned her life around, and now she helps other people find their way out of that same overwhelming situation that she had been in. And she developed what she calls the Clutterbug method. This method uses 4 different organizing styles, and they each have a different name: butterfly, bee, ladybug, and cricket. I think finding the organizing styles that fits us can be a really helpful thing. And so I've put together some visuals of her different styles just to help us kind of get our minds rolling and help us visualize what might work best for us. The first one is a butterfly organizer. So a butterfly organizer will do best when they organize their things in a very visual way. They need to be able to see their things at a glance. And while containing things is almost always helpful if you're organizing, for a butterfly, things need to be contained in clear bins or something that you can see through. Otherwise, they will forget that they have it or that it's there. So they also will do better if their things are organized into bigger categories. So this would be a good solution for a butterfly organizer: a big bin for all the health-related things. There's first aid, there's vitamins, there's painkiller. All of that stuff is in here together. It's in a clear bin. They can easily see what's there. This type of organizing is often what works well in children's spaces because their attention spans are a little bit shorter, and if they can see where they need to put their things and there's big categories, it takes less effort for them to throw it where they need to. The next one is a bee organizer. They are also visual organizers, but bee organizers, instead of having their things in big categories, they like to have smaller categories. Hopefully y'all can see this a little bit, but this is what their bin might look like. They might have a health bin, but they'll have a little section for painkillers. They'll have a little section for poison ivy creams, a little section for Band-Aids and gauze, and so on and so forth. So bee organizers are okay with taking a little more time to open an extra lid or stack and unstack something in order to keep their things in those smaller categories. Ladybug organizers are not so visual. Being able to see everything makes them feel cluttered. Solid bins and baskets work better for them, and having their things in cabinets with drawers or doors is better than maybe out on open shelving. And like butterflies, categories, large categories is often what they like best. So they might have a bin like this, but instead of being able to see their things, they might put it in something like this, where it's hidden. Cricut organizers are also hidden organizers, but instead of having large categories, they like to have everything tucked away and organized into detailed categories. So they might have the solid bin, but with the little categories inside. So hopefully that can give you a little idea of where you might come in. I find myself gravitating towards hidden organization with big categories. And so this helps me because when I go to organize a space, I might go to find some bins or, go to the store to get what I need. And when I see the clear bins, I'm usually tempted, but I don't usually do it because I have learned that if I take it home and try to organize that way, I end up still feeling cluttered instead of organized. So this may seem like a small, simple thing, but I think it's combining these small, simple things that will make a big difference in the long run. So if organizing is stressful and redundant for you, or it feels like it's just not working, Cass, who developed this system, she says, you are not failing, but your system might be. So check your system and see if there are adjustments that you can make to customize it to what will work for you and your household. But also, we all have different talents and strong points. And if that's really not your thing, the chances are that you have a friend who loves to organize and would jump for the chance to give you a hand. So maybe swap a couple hours of work and take something off her load that she doesn't enjoy. Maybe you could can her peppers or sew a dress or prep some freezer meals. There is tremendous blessing in sharing and swapping our gifts and talents with each other. Okay, we've talked about decluttering organization. And the next thing I have is to create routines in your household. We might think of routines as rigid and claustrophobic. Maybe we think that routines take away the possibility of being fun and spontaneous. And I think it is possible to live that lifestyle, but if you try a routine and that's the way that it makes you feel, maybe you are working with a strict schedule rather than a routine. Routines are simply a sequence of actions that we regularly follow, a rhythm that we create by ordering our tasks in a way that eventually become a habit. When we are willing to do some intentional work upfront and create those good routines, it can lead to having rhythms of peace in our daily lives because we eliminate the need to always make that conscious decision to get something done. And who does not like the idea of giving our busy brains a break? But before we create routines for our lives, we need to start with a vision. What are the things that we value, and what is our vision for the way we want our days to go and our house to be run? Felicia Masonheimer says that our vision leads to our priorities, and our priorities leads us to our routines. She suggests that we ask ourselves these questions to help us clarify our vision. What are my core values? What do I love about my current lifestyle, routines, the way I go about my daily tasks? What creates the most stress in a regular day? what do I want my house to be like in a year? And what do I want to see more of in my home and in my house? So after we have a vision for what we want to see, we can work on finding our priorities, and then we can concentrate on creating routines for the things that are highest priority to us. How do we go about developing that routine? Two different things to think about. What are the things that stress you out during an ordinary day? What makes you feel just anxious and overwhelmed and cranky? Maybe it's that supper crunch that you get into when you're trying to get food on the table, finish up the laundry, and pick up the house before your husband comes home. Or maybe it's that you don't have any time to yourself in the morning before your children are up. And then also think about the things that take extra time in your day. So are you checking your phone every time you get a notification? Or do you tend to jump from one task to another before it's finished? What are those things that are taking up precious time in tiny increments? So when you've thought through the stressors and the time wasters in your day, think about, what are things that I can do to solve these problems? Come up with some changes that you can make to alleviate those stress points and buy back more time. Also, are there areas in your life that you're lacking discipline? This isn't a fun one to think about, but being undisciplined can have a major domino effect and rob us of a lot of joy and peace in our daily lives. For example, if maybe one of the pain points for you is that you don't have a little bit of time in the morning to yourself before the rest of the family's up, maybe it's because you are always too tired to scratch yourself out of bed in the morning when your alarm clock goes. So consider, why am I always so tired in the morning? Maybe you scroll on your phone for an hour after you crawl into bed. So what if you decided not to touch your phone after 8? That would eliminate the late night scrolling, and no scrolling might give you an extra hour of solid sleep. And an extra hour of solid sleep might make getting up a lot easier. And then, guess what? Because of that one decision to discipline yourself and put your phone aside, you somehow have your quiet time back in the morning, and you're set up for a great start to your days again. The bottom line to this is that discipline leads to freedom, and we need to discipline ourselves into structure. Or maybe if you do find yourself living with that strict schedule that really is rigid and unbending, there is a possibility that you need to discipline yourself into flexibility. And the Holy Spirit will convict us of which of those we need the most if we ask Him and listen. So a well-running home is not built in one day. But if we implement one good change at a time and practice intentionality, I think we can soon experience those peaceful rhythms and more freedom in our daily lives. The opposite of having good routines and disciplines is procrastination and laziness. Abigail talked this morning about a 90-second rule, and I found a lady who is called Mel Robbins. She developed something called the 5-second rule during a really tough time in her life. She found herself in a huge financial crisis. She was struggling with anxiety and depression, stuck in a really bad drinking habit, and just feeling like she had absolutely failed at life. One morning, when she was reaching over to hit that snooze on her alarm clock once again, she suddenly was inspired that instead she would count backwards from five and then promptly get out of bed. So 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and get out of bed. And although at the time it seemed really odd to her and she had no idea really where that inspiration came from, and she didn't have any idea how powerful this little trick really was and that there was any science behind it, but she started to apply this technique to other areas of her life, and it ended up being the start to a completely new life for her. And here's why. This is the way that she explained it. When we are faced with something we need to do, a task or a decision, and we start to think about that thing for more than 5 seconds, we drift into the part of our brain that all of our default ways of talking to ourselves and our default patterns are stored. And this is where our brain contaminates our will to take action. And instead, we start to move towards what feels easiest. So counting backwards was an intentional action, and it requires focus. So what happens when we count 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 is that we interrupt our mind from going into that default mode, and instead we activate the part of our brain that we need to take action or learn a new behavior. So it's essentially what puts us in charge of ourselves. The exciting thing about this is that the second that we start that counting, we have already taken the first action. And then when we take that first action, we now have a little bit of momentum. And then, once again, there's that domino effect because we took the first action, it led to the next, and the next, and the next. And eventually, we find ourselves in a spot we never thought possible simply because we did the first right thing. So on that morning that Mel chose to interrupt her thought patterns, stop rationalizing her bad behavior, and jump out of bed instead of hitting the snooze button again, she began to develop the skill of taking action regardless of how she felt. So it's easy for us to wallow in self-pity and point our fingers at what all and who all is making things hard for us. But remember that when you are pointing a finger at other things or other people, there are three fingers pointing back at yourself. Your life won't change by thinking about it or thinking about other people. It changes by doing something about it yourself. Another little practical tip that someone once shared with me and that has helped me a little bit with procrastination issues is to just immediately take care of those tiny little two-minute tasks that we come across. So maybe if you're going to wipe the counter and you see the electric bill, it's easy just to push that chore down the pike because we know it won't take long, but when we don't take care of those things right away, we suddenly find ourselves with a lot of those little things, and our brains once again feel cluttered and overwhelmed. Okay, just a few more practical tips to keep in mind as we consider doing housekeeping well. We talked earlier about finding pain points in our schedules, and there are also other pain points around our houses that just make our daily tasks not much fun. The first few years after I was married, I had a blanket on our bed that was just barely big enough to cover. And every morning when I went to make my bed, I tugged and pulled and tugged and pulled some more and trying to get this blanket to look good. And I really disliked making my bed in the morning. until I finally identified this blanket as a pain point in my day, and I decided that would be my next thing to fix. So buying a bigger blanket solved the problem, and I really don't mind making my bed at all, and I'm dealing with one less pain point. We can probably think of a whole gaggle of things that we could go out and buy right now to fix all those pain points in our houses. But like we talked about before, we don't want to go breaking the bank and buying things willy-nilly, just not thinking about, without knowing that, you know, those things are going to add value. So I suggest just to take one thing at a time and think it through well. Maybe you could set aside a little bit of, you could set aside the money that your guests leave as a hostess gift. Or maybe you could add a little pain point fund to your budget, and then when you saved enough to fix a pain point, one that's bothering you the most, do it, and then do the same thing for the next one. I think that having a little saving fund gives you time to think about if your purchase is really one that you do want to make, and then it also gives you permission to spend that money without guilt to make something better or prettier that you would have otherwise just kept dealing with because you didn't feel like you should spend the money on it. My friend Sharla has inspired me with her goal to make one thing more beautiful every day. It doesn't need to be something big. It could be just taking a magic eraser to the scuffs on the front door, or some days it might just be that you put some pretty pie filling on your canning room shelves. But choosing to put that little bit of intentionality and thought into making something better or more beautiful can take just a regular mundane task or chore that we might drag our feet about, and it can turn it into something that is rewarding for ourselves, a meaningful service to our families, and I think when we have that attitude, we can even call it an act of service to God, or an act of worship to God. The last thing I have is to use scripture in your home decor. The Bible does not have a lot of specific things to say when it comes to how our houses should be, but I was convicted by this verse recently. Deuteronomy 6:6-9 says, "These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." So I think that's pretty clear, and it's not a hard thing to do. There are a lot of pretty ways that we can write them on our door frames of our houses and on our gates. And if we have the opportunity to impress on our family's hearts the words of God through our decor, why wouldn't we? It's definitely something that I want to incorporate in my home more. So at the beginning of this session, I asked the questions, is this stuff important? Does it matter? Does the Bible have anything to say about being organized or having routines, or does it matter to God? While we don't really read verses that give us very specific instruction on these things, I think that we can find principles in the Bible that speak to these issues. We can clearly see that God is a God of order. And the way that he designed the universe, the placement of the galaxies, planets and stars, the changing seasons, the passage of time from night to day, these are all examples of how God uses order. Even the design of our human bodies, like the heart pumping blood through our organs, shows that he created order. 1 Corinthians 14:33 says, "For God is not a God of confusion, but of peace, And in the same chapter, verse 40 says, everything should be done in a fitting and orderly way. There are also verses that speak to staying away from excess clutter and possessions. Matthew 6:19-21 says, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Ecclesiastes 3:6, there is a time to keep and a time to cast away. Luke 12:15, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Hebrews 12:1-2, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. So yes, I think we can conclude that God does care about these little things. They are important, and they do matter. I'll leave you with this verse from Colossians 3:23. Whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Master. God bless each of you as you let the will of God be done in your homes and in your houses. Let's do the work of home with joy, and remember that there is an eternal purpose in the mundane tasks of our daily lives.